From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, terrorist atrocities in Israel, Israeli atrocities in return, seeds sown, reaped, then sown again.
Hamas bears no small fault of blame or responsibility with respect to this, but Hamas wouldn't have been created except for the conditions that the Palestinians wind up living in. The collective punishment that Israel has imposed upon Gaza, particularly in the last 16 to 17 years with the blockade, is a fundamental violation of international humanitarian law.
Israel, Palestine, Russia, Ukraine, the U.S. versus Russia and China. What sense to be made?
A lot of the clamor and tumult you are listening to is the contradictions of capitalism just essentially entering their last throes. These are very, of course, dangerous times for precisely that reason. The West does not wish to accept this. So what you're hearing is a denial. You know, it's like the old man putting on dark hair dye and trying to look young. I mean, it's not going to work.
Before descending into the horror, help us deliver this weekly package of Earth News. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. In preparation for imminent Israeli ground invasion, thousands of Gazans are now fleeing the northern half of the tiny enclave, already devastated by 16 years of brutal siege. In response to last week's horrific assault on Israeli communities east of its Gaza ghetto, the Israeli military ordered Gaza's 1.1 million northern residents to get out. Almost a half million are now trying to do so. 1,300 Israelis perished in last week's horrific terrorist attack, mostly civilians, and 150 were taken hostage. 300 soldiers were killed. According to Gaza's health ministry, over 2,300 Gazans have been killed by Israeli bombs, including 700 children. 70 died in an airstrike on Friday, including children, in the course of fleeing. 10,000 have been wounded. In a news release this past Friday, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Internally Displaced Persons declared that Israel's evacuation order, after cutting off food, water, electricity, and fuel to Gaza, then dropping 6,000 bombs, some of them reportedly white phosphorus munitions, constitutes forcible transfer and collective punishment, crimes against humanity under international law. Forcible transfer and collective punishment are nothing new for Gazans. Three-quarters of the enclave's 2.3 million residents are already refugees or the descendants of refugees driven from their villages by Zionist militias in 1948. The lovely Israeli communities, brutally invaded by Palestinian militants last weekend, lie on or near the ruins of those Palestinian villages, an irony mainstream media has ignored. The GPM spoke about the unfolding situation in Gaza and Israel with Michael Link. Link is Associate Professor of Law at Western University in London, Ontario. Between 2016 and 2022, Link served as UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory, occupied since 1967. Hello, Michael Link. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
David, thank you very much for having me. Always a pleasure.
These are very depressing times. There's no moral or ethical clarity. There's vast volumes of confusion and ignorance about history. And it's hard to make sense of this awful act of violence that these militants committed in the course of those hours in southern Israel. But now Israel is unleashing vast, vast, colossal violence on Gaza. What sense do you make of all this?
Well, David, we can think of this in two different levels. The first, obviously, is the visceral and the immediate. And what happened in Israel on Saturday with the death of what now appears to be around 1,200 Israelis, the large number of whom are civilians, and the kidnapping and hostage-taking of perhaps 50 to 100 back into Gaza, is abhorrent. It's a violation of every norm of international law. It's a violation of all of our norms of morality. So I think we have to say that and say that unequivocally. What has been happening in retaliation or revenge, and what is likely to be much more massive in the weeks to come, is going to be immense bloodshedding in Gaza, largely by innocent Palestinian civilians. International law does not recognize an eye for an eye. That leads us to the land of the blind, as Gandhi would say. So on the visceral level, I think we all have a feeling of being appalled, shocked, dismayed. My term is gutted with respect to what's happened. As someone who's followed this for several decades, it is, you know, at a political level, and I when I say this term, I don't mean to diminish the immense loss of life, but for the Palestinians, at least for the foreseeable future, it's what would be called an own goal in soccer. I mean, this puts back the work of those who believe in justice and peace and a compassionate resolution in Israel-Palestine a long ways. It makes it harder to explain that this and provide the proper context to it with respect to this is a relationship between an occupier and an occupied. And as a lawyer, if I can say on a broader level, you know, there are distinct rules of international law that no matter how just the cause is, there are things that the law does not permit you to wind up doing. The use of mass indiscriminate violence against civilians cannot be justified under law, even if the Palestinians have a right to resist, which they do have a right to resist under international law.
Do they have the right to resist with violence?
They have the right to resist with violence, even. But that would have to be directed towards soldiers and occupying military force. It would have to be directed towards military bases. It would have to be directed towards anything that constituted a military component of the occupation. But we also have to realize that the Palestinians are extremely outgunned, if you like. The military might that Israel has is far and superior to what the Palestinians could wind up mustering. And I've said for a long time, and there are many Palestinians who will say the same, is that by far the best strategic, political, and moral path to follow is to develop a campaign of political nonviolence. That is the way in which you win public opinion. That is the way in which you show, if you like, the brutality of the occupation. An Israeli general several years ago admitted, we don't do Gandhi very well. You wind up exposing the weak parts of an occupation that is now the longest occupation in the modern world. So those would be the paths that I think are probably politically wise, morally wise, diplomatically wise, and it takes advantage of the energy of civil society. I lived in Jerusalem and Bethlehem in 1989 at the height of the first Palestinian Intifada. I was working for the United Nations doing human rights and refugee work, and I saw the power of nonviolent and resistance, of civil disobedience. And it produced significant gains for the Palestinians. I think a continuation, a widening of that would have been the best way to wind up proceeding. But I also understand, and look, I've spent my 6 years when I was the UN Special Rapporteur preaching and preaching again with respect to the absolute indispensability of the international community and of Israel and of the Palestinians following international law, the rules of international humanitarian law, human rights law, criminal law, with respect to this, to little avail. You know, Israel has lived on the other side of the red line with respect to international law for almost all of its occupation, and it only winds up getting worse in terms of its violations of the Fourth Geneva Convention, the whole body of human rights treaties, of international criminal law, the Rome Statute. And when the Palestinians see that the world is not coming to their rescue with respect to international law and the many defiances by Israel of UN Security Council resolutions and UN General Assembly resolutions, then it gives credence to those who say, why pay attention to international law? Why pursue nonviolence? Why follow diplomacy when the enemy won't listen and the world won't come to rescue us? International law to work also requires international resolve. When you have both international law and international resolve put together, you have a situation where the rules of the world are likely going to wind up working.
Michael Link, I want to ask you, no one can justify or condone, much less support what these Hamas militants did, but one can certainly try to understand why they did what they did. Can you tell me what the situation is in Gaza? You've written, when you were a special rapporteur, you devoted a lot of your time and effort investigating and reporting on the situation in Gaza. Could you sum up for us what the situation is in Gaza and has been for the last certainly 16 years since the start of Israel's siege that would drive people like Hamas militants to do what they did?
Sure. Look, and I think you said it right. What I'm going to be telling you is about the conditions in Gaza. This helps to explain or even to understand what we saw over the last 4 days. It doesn't justify it. So I say that in this particular context. Many international observers have said that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory is brutal. And Gaza is at the sharp end of this brutal stick. Gaza is made up of over 2.3 million people, Palestinians, living in a walled-off enclave on the shores of the Mediterranean, where they are completely blockaded, where Israel has since 2006 conducted a comprehensive air, sea, and land blockade that nothing gets in and nobody gets in, and nothing gets out and nobody gets out except with Israeli permission. And Israel allows just enough supplies of water, power, food, diesel, and goods to enter into Gaza to keep that, their head above water, but not to let them reach any kind of island of autonomy or self-determination. So what we have in Gaza is a humanitarian crisis that's been going on for decades now. Keep in mind, of the 2.3 million Palestinians who live in Gaza, 67% of them are refugees or descendants of refugees. Almost 50%, I think it's probably right now the figure is 47% of the population of Gaza is 18 years or under. So it's a very young population that's never known anything except the very tight quarters that they wind up living in.
Refugees from where?
Refugees from areas in what is now the Israeli south, from along the coast between Gaza and Tel Aviv. There were a number in 1948, a number of Palestinian villages, towns, and communities as well. Deeper inland in the Israeli Negev were very large Palestinian populations. They were driven out in 1948. 1949 by Israel during the creation of the State of Israel, and they wound up in refugee camps from that area, some in the southern West Bank, many of them in Gaza, penniless, impoverished, and with only the assistance coming through the United Nations. What we have today is a collapsing healthcare system for the 2.3 million Palestinians who are there. They have a very inadequate third world healthcare system with inadequate staff, difficulties in obtaining medical equipment for treatment beyond primary care, because Israel blocks shipments of medical equipment coming into Gaza, as well as real shortages of pharmaceuticals to be able to treat the population. So when you have an emergency health crisis that is going on now, you have the hospitals overwhelmed with the badly injured who are, and the hospitals are already trying to cope with the ordinary flow of Gazans who need medical attention. You have sanitation issues where there's a lack of fuel to be able to power the sanitation facilities to be able to treat the waste that's generated in Gaza. So much of the waste winds up going in unfiltered into the Mediterranean Sea, which creates obviously the danger of serious health problems and the spread of communicable diseases. Water is one of the most serious issues in the Gaza Strip. Gaza sits on a coastal aquifer, which is 97% contaminated, undrinkable because of the seepage of seawater and of sewage into there. So potable water is produced either by water that comes in from Israel, which the Gazans have to buy, or through desalination plants, which only run with fuel. And the desalination plant only works for, supplies water for about 30% of the population. You have large amounts of food which enter into Gaza. They do have some farming areas, but right now with the destructions that are going on, we're having issues with the ability of those who have chicken farms or livestock farms. They're liable to collapse because they don't have the fodder, which is imported, to be able to feed the chicken and the livestock, which place not only the livelihood of these herders and farmers at risk, it just means the ability to be able to supply food for the population in Gaza, such as eggs or yogurt or cheese or protein or meat, is all going to be at risk within the next several days with this total blockade that Israel has imposed since Saturday.
And of course, Israel says, we weep for the poor Gazans, but this is all Hamas's fault. And of course, this is the same, the United States and Canada and the European Union, they all say the same thing. It really is all Hamas's fault. Then Israel has the right to sustain this blockade because it's threatened by Hamas, these wild, crazy terrorists.
Well, the answers to that are several. Look, Hamas bears no small fault of blame or responsibility with respect to this. But Hamas wouldn't have been created except for the conditions that the Palestinians wind up living in. And indeed, the origins of Hamas come from Israeli support in the 1980s as a counterweight to the rise of Palestinian nationalist organizations fighting the occupation at that point. But as a lawyer, I want to make it very clear, the collective punishment that Israel has imposed upon Gaza, particularly in the last 16 to 17 years with the blockade, is a fundamental violation of international humanitarian law. Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention expressly forbids collective punishment with no exceptions. And now, with this total siege that's now been imposed of no food, no water, no electricity, no goods going into Gaza, that's been imposed since the weekend. This again is a violation of international humanitarian law. International humanitarian law forbids the use of starvation as a tool to punish civilians during a military action. It forbids the use of coercive tactics, such as banning or lessening the availability of food, water, electricity, and any other goods needed for survival in a civilian population during the course of war. This has been cited on a number of occasions during the prior wars on Gaza, beginning in 2008, where purported war crimes were documented by successive human rights tribunals set up by the United Nations Human Rights Council. And they have, on 2008, 2009, 2014, 2018, 2019, I'll just cite just three of the major reports. They all cited the disturbing nature in which Israel was violating international law in its attacks on Gaza. And to give you one example, in 2014, there was a 50-day assault on Gaza, which left in the end 2,300 Palestinians dead in Gaza, 1,500 of whom, about two-thirds, were civilians. And the report that came out afterwards noted the, quote, the impunity that prevails across the board for violations of international humanitarian and human rights law allegedly committed by Israeli forces. Israel must break with its recent lamentable track record in holding wrongdoers accountable. So revenge is something that's not permitted in international law. Israel has been dealt a deadly blow by the loss of, it appears to be, around 1,200 Israelis, many of whom are civilians. But revenge is not the answer. And as we've seen from these repeated escalation of assaults over the last 15 years, there is no military solution to this. The only solution is politics, diplomacy, under the framework of international law, to bring to an end the justified grievances of the Palestinians under occupation and to allow for a free Palestine.
Where do you come down, Michael Wink, on the use of language descriptors of Hamas? Is Hamas a terrorist organization? Are they terrorists? Trudeau just said, quote, they aren't freedom fighters, they are terrorists, and no one in Canada should be supporting them, much less celebrating them. And Joe Biden has just announced that Hamas, they are the new ISIS. But what sense do you make of who Hamas is and what they are, what they represent?
Sure. What they represent would be a strain not only of Palestinian, but they are reflective of a broader, you know, Arab political mobilization that rose in the 1970s and the 1980s, and there were antecedents before, which saw the failure of secular Arab groups and their inability to be able to either effectively achieve liberation during the anti-colonial periods in the 50s and 60s, or wound up seeing these secular organizations rule in a corrupt and inefficient manner. They grew up generally as pious organizations built around, obviously, religious political ideology based on the Quran, and were able to articulate a yearning that many Arabs, and in our case, Palestinians, would have had for an effective resistance movement that would address those forces that were afflicting them. What Hamas has evolved into, obviously, is the widespread and promiscuous use of terror tactics, which target individuals and have left it utterly isolated in the international community. I think there was a period when it could have been said that Hamas, notwithstanding some of its appalling record, should have been recognized as a legitimate political force and found ways of at least bringing in those who weren't committed to using not armed struggle, but using terror tactics into a political negotiation process that would have helped to resolve and build a compassionate peace. That may be too late politically to be able to do that now. But your comment with respect to use of language, you know, tells me that for all of these major UN commissions that have been initiated since 2008 and 2009, saying that Israel, its military and its political leadership, have likely committed war crimes in its various assaults on Gaza in particular, and as well through the building of Israeli settlements, which are war crimes under the Rome Statute and under Canadian legislation, why that attachment, that word war crime or war criminal, isn't attached to them, speaks, I think, of a rather skewed vision we have of where the law winds up applying. I never hear any Western leaders suggest anything more than Israel might be at fault in international law with respect to, well, the annexation of East Jerusalem or the building of settlements. But to use the word war crimes, which settlements are, which the annexation of occupied land is, and the use of indiscriminate military force also is, I guess, a language we have to begin to cultivate to be able to say that there's fault on all sides. And my mission as a special rapporteur was to point out these serious violations of international law by Israel, but also by Hamas, and to say that the path to a compassionate peace is through the use, the sturdy guardrails of international law and human rights. West, Europe, North America, you wind up discarding or putting aside international law. A, you ensure that there's not going to be a just and lasting peace in the Middle East. But two, you wind up exposing or risking the accusations of hypocrisy by your use of international law when it comes to Ukraine and to the occupation of Crimea by Russia, but don't apply the very same standards to Israel and its occupation of Palestinian territory.
Where do you see this going, Michael Wink? What do you think Israel's ultimate aims are? What's its goal? I've been hearing talk about Israel possibly wanting to actually drive out the people of Gaza, totally demolish, devastate Gaza, and then drive people out to wherever, across the border into Egypt, if you can imagine such a thing. Empty Gaza out and reoccupied physically. So where do you see this going?
Well, look, there's two ways in which this can go, David. First, that the coming assault on Gaza will be focused only on Gaza. We know from 2014, with the same prime minister in power, that there was a 50-day war on Gaza, which led to, as I said, 2,300 Palestinians being killed. Given the ferocity of the Hamas attack, largely on Israeli civilians, one may think that the strategic goal now of Israel is not simply more, to use their awful euphemism, cutting of the grass or mowing the grass, but to actually decapitate Hamas completely. And that would require, you know, probably the reoccupation of Gaza. And then the question is, you enter the store and break the glass, you own it. What does Israel then do with Gaza? Because you can be sure that the Palestinian Authority would not be interested in wanting to come into Gaza and rule it behind Israeli bayonets. So that's one possibility. The other is a wider conflict. That might happen if there is a sustained uprising as well in the West Bank. If suddenly things become very hot in the border between Lebanon and Israel. We already have seen some skirmishes with soldiers killed on both sides between Hezbollah and the Israeli army. Hezbollah, as we know, is exceptionally well-armed with hundreds and maybe thousands of missiles stored in southern Lebanon that could easily penetrate into Israel. And there has always been a strategic desire among the Israeli military and Israeli political leadership to want to be able to tackle the growing nuclear capabilities of Iran. If there's enough intelligence relationships that are put out in public between Iran and what Hezbollah is doing or what Hamas is doing, one can imagine a situation where Israel might be tempted to take on Iran as well. This could also mean the expulsion of some Palestinians. I think the odds are low with respect to all this, but one always knows that it's easy to start a war. It's very hard to end a war on the terms that you want it. So these types of conflicts, particularly in the Middle East, have the potential for flying out of control with consequences that nobody foresaw at the very beginning.
What do you think the possibilities are of suddenly positive transformative change, ironically or paradoxically, because of Israel, overstepping, crossing a red line, saying things like their Yoav Galant, their defense minister, referring to Palestinians as human animals, and all this talk about totally devastating Gaza and committing acts that are just so obviously transgressions of international law, mass casualties, that suddenly a solution is crystallized. Not a whole regional conflagration, but the opposite of that. Do you see any prospects for such a positive thing to unfold?
Sure, David. Look, I'm an eternal optimist, and part of my optimism comes from being a lawyer, and it comes from believing in the sanctity of international law and in a rules-based framework and in the primacy of human rights. I believe that with educating again about the importance of respecting the rule of law in any conflict, it can be solved and resolutions consistent with the rights of people and with equality can be found. But in this case, I must say, I feel quite pessimistic. I don't see any happy ending to this, and I don't see the ability for a genuine Palestinian self-determination emerging anytime in the future. The way in which, particularly the United States, has said unreservedly that Israel, we don't see you having any red lines for the foreseeable future in how you conduct this war. Rarely has an Israeli leader launched a war with so much support coming from its chief patron, the United States, which in the hands of the current government lead me to think that we're going down a very, very dark place, and we're further and further away than ever to a successful resolution of this. I fear that there's going to be even more repression once the dust settles, and there's going to be even a greater call for bloodletting from Israeli political leaders supported by a significant portion of the Israeli population. Look, I understand in a moment like this that the blood of many Israelis is boiling, and they're going to be angry at Palestinians and particularly Gaza. They're going to be eventually angry at their prime minister for what they will perceive to be intelligence failures to have prevented this. But I'm not sure their direction is going to be where it really needs to be, that the only way out of this is political and diplomatic. The only way out of this is a final, just and lasting peace with the Palestinians. As long as the Palestinian question remains off in the distance for the Israeli public, I don't see any happy endings anytime soon.
Last question, Michael Link, following up on that. What's your message to Palestine solidarity activists? It's a very broad community. But these days, I've been reading and hearing that it's become potentially hazardous for activists to get up and wave Palestinian flags or shout from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. You know, much less voice support for Palestinian resistance. There's news now out of France that France is throwing out people on residence visas who, I don't know what they've said or what they've done, but it's now hazardous to be standing up for Palestine, isn't it?
Well, it's not a good moment for anybody, whether they're an activist or a professional observer or somebody who has argued or pointed out, as I have through my UN mandate, the necessity of trying to find a just and final resolution to the question of Palestine. But these things have happened in the past. And I think we've moved on in every case with respect to this. What I can say is that nobody should be calling what happened on Saturday or Saturday and Sunday an act of resistance. It isn't an act of resistance. There is no justification for it. You know, people may have been misguided in calling it that. People may have been certainly those who committed the atrocities that occurred on Saturday were not doing so with their own best interest in mind with regards to advancing the Palestinian cause. The Palestinian cause will remain. There will be an occupation for the foreseeable future. It will remain to be one that's one of annexation and of apartheid and of gross human rights violations. That will eventually come back to center peace on the world diplomatic table. And the world will have to realize that they have to wind up addressing that. Those far-sighted statespersons, after the end of the current assault on Gaza, may begin to realize they cannot continue to ignore the Palestinian issue or keep it on a perpetual back burner, that the only way to ensure these sorts of things are not perpetuated in the future is to finally grapple with the core of the Middle East question, which is the Palestinian question.
And the right the Palestinian people to self-determination.
Correct. Exactly. Exactly.
Thank you, Michael Link, so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
My pleasure, David. I'm happy to do this for you at any time. Good luck with your work.
Michael Link is Associate Professor of Law at Western University in London, Ontario, specializing in labor, human rights, disability, constitutional and administrative law. Between 2016 and 2022, Link served as UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory, occupied since 1967. Listen to our complete conversation at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. In search of ways to describe the world today, songwriters and poets are never at a loss for words. It's a crazy, mixed-up world. Well-fed masters reap the harvests of the polluted seeds they've sown. The gambling man is rich, the working man is poor. Everybody's crying peace on earth just as soon as we win this war. In search of a scholarly explanation for the world today, I spoke with Radhika Desai, Desai is a professor in the Department of Political Studies and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group at the University of Manitoba in Canada. Hello, Radhika Desai. Welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Well, lovely to be here, David, and great to catch up with you after a while.
Can you introduce yourself for those people who don't know who Radhika Desai is?
Sure. I am a professor of political studies at the University of Manitoba, and I suppose one of the main things that I want known about what I do is that some years ago, about a decade ago, I published a book called Geopolitical Economy, proposing a novel way of looking at world affairs in such a way where states matter, and conceiving of the system of international relations as a dialectical struggle between imperialism and anti-imperialism. So that's me.
Well, this is a great introduction to my first question. It's always a quandary. Should I start with a specific question and then move to the general, or should I start with the general and move to the specific? But let me start with the general, since you've kind of broached this. Do you have a unified theory, Radhika Desai, about what's going on in the world today? I mean, Israel, Palestine, suddenly, since last Saturday, Ukraine and Russia is totally, well, I mean, it's no longer being reported on in The Guardian, which is my go-to place for news reporting. There are lots of other places, but suddenly Ukraine, Russia has been eclipsed, and now it's just what's going on in Israel, Palestine, and Gaza. But if you look at these places and struggles between China and the West and what's going on in North Korea, and do you have a unified theory for what the heck is going on in the world? It seems like we're just constantly, we are on the edge of catastrophe.
Yes. Well, I mean, I would say that I suppose it's in a certain sense a unified theory. I mean, obviously, you know, there are always grand theories, and you know, Albert Einstein, it is famously said, would never really arrived at his general theory of relativity. He only got his special theory of relativity, so who knows? But nevertheless, I have tried to create a general understanding of world affairs and the way in which I think about it. The reason why we are in such a tumultuous period in world history, where, you know, I like to joke that over the past several years, just keeping up with the news has become a full-time occupation. The reason for that is essentially that the power of imperialism, which has been declining, albeit slowly, since about 1914, is now experiencing a relatively rapid slide. One of the key reasons for that is, of course, the rise of China, but it is also associated with the fact that despite the best efforts of the West to prevent it, there are today enough countries in the world with not exactly vast amounts of power, but enough power to resist Western demands, Western imperialism, etc., etc. So what we have is a situation in which the West's writ no longer runs. And in this context, rather than accepting it as the felicitous result of the at least some development taking place in at least some parts of the world, the West is fighting this development tooth and nail. And it is fighting the inevitability of further decline. So really, in a certain sense, I would say that a lot of the clamor and tumult you are listening to is the contradictions of capitalism just, you know, essentially banging, you know, essentially entering their last throes in some ways. But these are very, of course, dangerous times for precisely that reason.
Do you think that capitalism is entering its last throes?
Yes.
I mean, you would never know that listening or watching to CBC or CNN or even Al Jazeera, for that matter. There's a whole lot of other news outlets, but capitalism is in its last throes.
Well, like I said, the West does not wish to accept this. So what you are hearing is a denial of, you know, it's like the old man putting on dark hair dye and trying to look young. I mean, it's not going to work. right? So, I mean, I think what we have, I just recently published a book called Capitalism, Coronavirus and War. And it began really as capitalism and coronavirus, because I felt that the pandemic was telling on capitalism in both senses of the term. That is to say, it was revealing the dirty secrets of capitalism, its productive debility, its obscene inequality, its social division, its political breakdown, everything. And on top of that, it was telling on it in the second sense of the term, which is it was putting unbearable burdens on capitalism. So the onset of the, and then the proxy war against Russia started. And so I rolled that into it as well, because it related to the same aspects and the same historical moment in the life of capitalism that I was thinking of. So absolutely, I think that there is no doubt in my mind that we are looking at the last throes of capitalism. And it is also completely unsurprising to me that you will not read about it in the headlines of the CBC or the Guardian or the Financial Times.
And what's replacing capitalism? What will replace capitalism 50 or 100 years down the road? Of course, meanwhile, it's just been reported 40% of the ice sheet along Western Antarctica has melted. So we're on the precipice of major global ecologic catastrophe. And so to ask, well, what's going to replace capitalism 50 or 100 years from now? It could be complicated.
It could be an irrelevant question, is what you're trying to say. And I think you're absolutely right.
Forget about climate catastrophe. What's going to replace capitalism?
Well, no, hang on. Let's first talk about climate catastrophe and then talk about what's going to replace capitalism. So basically, I notice on your website that you refer to Anthropocene. You know, we are in the Anthropocene. But actually, a lot of people that I know and respect, actually, and who do much more work than I've ever done on the environmental question, call it the Capitalocene. Because I don't think, I mean, you know, the word Anthropocene implies that us human beings, simply by existing and breathing, are destroying the planet. But that's not the case. This kind of neo-Malthusianism, which sort of seems to blame everything on human beings, and of course, the number of human beings, this is really something we should get away from. So what I'm trying to say is that particularly, if you look at practically any index of which indicates the level of ecological destruction, whether it is biodiversity loss or climate change, you know, rising temperatures or whatever, all sorts of things, you will see that, you know, while of course they were going up, they began to go up very steeply starting about 1980, which is also the onset of neoliberalism. So neoliberalism, which is really a capitalism essentially fighting back the socialistic measures that were imposed upon it through popular will after the end of the Second World War, this is capitalism fighting back and earning freedom, for particularly for big corporate capital, once again, this is the result of that, because you let capital do what it likes, and not only does it deliver to you decades of limping and slow growth, but it also at the same time accelerates the destruction of the environment and the destruction of our planet. And by the way, I should say, you know, people used to reflect that, ever since people became conscious of the environmental, the slow environmental death of our planet, that people have stopped worrying about nuclear war. And, you know, what's really interesting about the present moment is that both possibilities, on the one hand, the sorts of international agreements that are absolutely, you know, they're the sine qua non of getting out of this climate catastrophe. They have been completely sidelined. There is no possibility of that, given that the West will not even sit down and talk with some of the most important countries in the world. So not only has that happened, the current level of conflict and crisis has prevented that. On the other hand, the current level of conflict and crisis is bringing us that close to nuclear war. So take your pick, slow death or quick death. That's what we are facing right now.
So do you think the emerging, like I asked you, so what's going to replace capitalism? I suppose it will be whatever China comes up with ultimately, and other major East Asian economies, perhaps the Indian economy, but the Chinese economy is the most in resurgence. It's rising. What will that new economic force bring to the planet? What will be its alternative to the environmental planetary destruction that capitalism has brought us.
Right. So first of all, let me say a couple of things. Number one, it's actually, so one of the implications of saying that we are living in the capitalocene, one of the implications of pointing out that we are in neoliberalism and that neoliberalism has accelerated practically every accelerated the destruction of the planet on practically every front, is to say, therefore, that we will not be able to address this problem, which you rightly feel is very important, without having some sort of socialism. Now, I say some sort of socialism because I would say that in my own, you know, you asked about my grand theory, and in my grand theory of geopolitical economy, I feel that the alternative to capitalism must be some sort of socialism. That is to say, some sort of economy in which people control the government and the economies are run for their welfare, which includes the welfare of the planet, because where are we without that? But we cannot have that as long as the reins of policy in our economies are held by a small number of powerful capitalists, which is what we have right now. China, on the other hand, is in a very meaningful sense socialist, in the sense that it is still socialist. People love to say, you know, China has just become capitalist. Look, they have so many capitalists and blah, blah, and so on. And my answer to that is, look, China has definitely got a lot of capitalists. There is also no doubt in my mind that those capitalists are quite powerful. They are very rich. And I would say that one front on which I would criticize China is they have too much inequality, partly as a result of the wealth of these capitalists. I would go further step forward and say that these capitalists have a lot of political power, in the sense that they are also part of the Communist Party and reach quite a long way up the hierarchy of the Communist Party. But, and here comes the qualification, at the end of the day, it is the party state that has the upper hand, the party states that hold the reins of power, not the capitalists. And when necessary, the party state has brought the capitalists on the carpet, told them off, told them what they can have and what they can't have. And that, I would say, is still, therefore, makes China a non-capitalist, in some ways a meaningfully socialist country, whose legitimacy, the party state's legitimacy, relies on delivering goods to the vast majority of the Chinese population. And I would say China has done pretty darn well in this respect, particularly given that it has achieved what prosperity it has achieved for its people without the privilege of imperialism, which the Western countries, you know, all their wealth, they think they are very wealthy because they are so smart and so productive. No, they're very wealthy because in a very critical way, the vast bulk of their wealth actually relies on the structures of imperialism.
Do you see China as its power and influence, economic influence, grows in the world, pulling us out of the carbon economy?
Yes, China has actually, and again, there are other people who know this much better and know the technological aspects much better than me. But I would say that China is in the forefront of a number of major environmental measures. I mean, it's already the largest producer of solar panels, of electric vehicles. The streets of China and the air of China's cities is actually pretty clean. If you think about, you know, if by contrast, if you go to India, you will have the absolute opposite experience, where I remember listening to a CBC story, actually, or was it a BBC story? Anyway, some public broadcaster had done a story about just how bad the air of cities in India is, so that you have young children who have the lungs of a heavy smoker. Young children. So that's the contrast. So China is also massively reforesting. China is investing in public services, public transport, etc., etc. So in all of these ways, I would say that, and China has absolutely no interest. You see, what the reason people forget, you know, why, what exactly is causing climate change? Like I say, you have to really think about capitalism, its contradictions, and the way in which capitalism has unfolded, particularly over the last 40 odd years. That is what is at root of the acceleration of the destruction of the planet, and not what happens if you run societies and economies in the interests of their people.
And yet countries like, I mean, forgive me for the facile question, the pedestrian question, or kind of lending credence to facile arguments, but countries like Canada and the United States, of course, they paint, and the media paints China as a malign force in the world, economically, politically, as a country that, and they impose sanctions on Chinese technology and seek to block the advancement and the proliferation of Chinese technology. Talk about this.
Sure. I mean, look, first of all, let me just say that the demonization of any country or group or people is the prelude to war on them. This is what we are looking at, for example, in the case of Gaza. I don't know if you saw, but finally, the Biden administration has had to backtrack on this, this beheading of babies story about Gaza, right? But the whole point is the circulation of such stories allows you to then portray these people as animals, as I believe, I think one of the major, perhaps it was Netanyahu or some major Israeli official has essentially called people of Gaza animals. Once you do that, then it creates the consent for you to essentially destroy them, you know, with whatever means necessary. So the same sort of demonization has been going on about Russia, about Venezuela, about Iran, about China. Every country, of course, North Korea, every country in the world that has dared stand up to the power of the West has received this sort of treatment. Because you see, and so that's the first thing I want to say. The other thing I want to say is that, you know, in the West, we are so darn hypocritical. Because on the one hand, we keep talking about how much we are interested in the development of these third world countries. But the moment they actually develop, we hate them. We hate China. We hate China's guts. Because why? Because when the United States and everybody else following the United States began to engage with China, the idea was that the West was acquiring a very fine new colony, which was going to serve the master countries very well by producing cheap goods, you know, labor-intensive goods based on cheap wages, etc. And undoubtedly, for a short while, China was doing exactly that. But by the new century, it became very clear that China had no intention of remaining a low-cost producer. So from the beginning of the 2000s, we had first President George Bush slapping his steel tariffs and aluminium tariffs on China, and then you got Obama doing his pivot to Asia, you know, because this was the new threat to the United States and its power. And then you had Trump declaring his new Cold War with China and President Biden pursuing it ever more zealously. So what you see is that the West actually, for all its protestations to the contrary notwithstanding, actually does not wish to see development in third world countries, in countries like China. Because the moment they develop, they also will assert themselves. They are not going to take the sort of schoolmarmish treatment. You know, I think it was, I forget who it was, maybe it was... Anyway, some famous person who deals with China on a regular basis, maybe it was Kissinger, you know, or somebody like, Larry Summers actually said that. He said some official in some other country anyway told him that when we talk to the Americans, all we get is a lecture. But when we talk to the Chinese, we get roads and bridges and airports and railway stations and so on. So this is a whole new world in which basically the West doesn't know where to put itself. It has been at the top of this world for a brief couple of hundred years, and now it thinks that it owns this position in the world hierarchy. Well, it doesn't.
Tell me about the role of institutions like the Eastern Economic Forum and the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank, and BRICS is another story, but all these other economic blocks and economic alliances that essentially compete with the G7.
Yeah, well, I think that all of these, I mean, you're basically selecting, there are other such things, the SCO, there are various other gatherings. Anyway, there's the group of friends of the Charter of the United Nations. I mean, all of these new organizations, international organizations that are coming into existence are essentially sort of marking the various stages of the decline of Western power and the increasing assertion of non-Western power, whether they are, well, they're concentrated to a substantial extent in Asia and East Asia in particular, but they also exist. I mean, Venezuela has been there all along, Cuba for the last 70 years, for crying out loud, 60 years, sorry, 60 plus years, has been standing up to the United States right next to this Goliath, beside whom it has the sad luck of having to exist. So all of these countries are increasingly asserting themselves and saying there's absolutely no reason why we should accept the diktats of the West. And we can, and we are beginning to think about a new world order, and we are going to try and fashion it in some way. And I think this is, you see, I call geopolitical economy, the approach that I have proposed for world affairs, I call it the discipline of multipolarity, because you are in the Netherlands. I have a very wonderful Dutch friend called Kees van der Pijl, who wrote a critical book about international relations, basically pointing out that it was the discipline of Western supremacy. And so if that is the case, and I agree with him, it's a very wonderful and persuasive book, then geopolitical economy, which, unlike globalization or US hegemony theories and so on, actually understands, can explain how we got to multipolarity and can see the progressive potential contained in multipolarity. I call geopolitical economy the discipline of multipolarity, and understanding how and why these new organizations are emerging and what they are doing, what they are able to do and what they still find difficult to do. All of this is part of understanding the transition of the world with the weakening of imperialism into something new, something different, which will inevitably be some form of socialism, as I say, where capitalists do not hold the reins of power, but where economies will be run in the interests of ordinary people. And of course, that for that to happen, ordinary people have to take the initiative. They have to create the movements and the parties that are going to take control of the state.
Radhika Desai is professor in the Department of Political Studies and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group at the University of Manitoba, Canada. She's also the convener of the International Manifesto Group. Listen to our whole conversation, including Radhika's encounter with Vladimir Putin at an academic gathering at greenplanetmonitor.net. I'll also post links to Radhika's suggested alternative news sources. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out. For now.